All right, there is an important machlokas, which is relevant to our shiur today, is that there is a machlokas hachumashim as to how long Shlishi of Vayigash is. So this is an important nafkamina for us. So most chumashim that I looked at have, including the fancy tikkun, has a shorter Vayigash Shlishi, which ends with Pasuk Yidches. Parak Memhei Pasuk Yidches. A couple of chumashim go further and include some significant psukim that would take us a while to talk about. So since rov of the chumashim have the shorter version, and because we also want to talk about Chanukah too, so we're going to pass in like the shorter version of what Shlishi is, but you should be aware that some chumashim have it different. And hopefully next year I'll remember that we did the shorter one this year, so the parallel revi, because there are some interesting points in the twilight zone between them. So. But we'll take the shorter version. So this is, we're coming again in the middle of a dramatic story, that here Yosef is now telling his brothers to go back home and to bring back Yaakov now that they know who he is, and that we should reunite. So he says, V'ata la'atem shalachtem osihena ki ha'elokim v'yasimeni la'av l'faro that you are not the ones who sent me here. It was the Eibishter, it was the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And he placed me as Av l'Faro, Adon l'chol beiso, Moshe b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. So we mentioned last week that those nine l'Torah, the Litzke Rav, has a comment which he repeats over here. So it's again a week-to-week synergy. The synergy of Shlishi last week, Shlishi this week, which we also find sometimes examples of. That Paro gave Yosef a triple ministry, three portfolios. And that's reflected here as well, that he was primarily the economic minister. But as the economic minister, he had also legislative responsibilities because he couldn't pull off his plan unless people had legal obligations to save the way he wanted them to and spend the way he wanted them to. And also he had to worry about riots. He had to worry about people attacking him. And therefore he had to have defense capability as well. So he suggests again that these three ministries are referenced here. Three different jobs. Av l'Faro, that was the lawmaker. Adon l'chol beiso, that's the finance minister. U'moisho b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, that's the defense minister. But there happens to be a lot of discussion about the concept of Moshe b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. Some point out that it's a little bit surprising for various reasons. So, for example, there's some who note that he wasn't actually a Moshe b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, he's the vice Moshe. So, in some svarim, it's suggested that this is one of many things that we'll see in this aliyah, that Yosef is trying to send back a message, don't worry about my spirituality, don't worry about where I'm holding now that you have found me in this den of iniquity that is Mitzrayim. So don't think that I have fallen prey to temptations, but rather I'm the Moshe b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. I am in charge of my Yetzirah, I am in charge of the temptations here. So that's the way that Chassam Sofer understood the Pasuk. Others had a different spin, a very different spin. And the Rashiv of Kambi Avner of Goldwicht has a whole essay about one of the shorter essays, but he has a whole essay on this pasuk, a whole short essay, where he talks about the bitachon of Yosef. And he says the bitachon of Yosef was not normal bitachon, it was on a whole different level. And he says sometimes people have bitachon that they say, okay, God runs the world, but I was successful, let's say that, you know, in Chanukah you could say, all right, God runs the world, he made us win the war, but my talents, my skills were the kli. You know, that I am a capable guy, and I understand that Kosh Baruch Hu was really running things, but he used me as the successful emissary in order to perform this victory. And there's a whole different level beyond that, even though that's decent, that's to some degree of bitacha. But Rashi Vinod Nim Rabbein Yon in his commentary to Mishlei, but there's a whole other madrega where somebody just completely recognizes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge of everything and doesn't even see his role as even as much as what we said a second ago, and recognizes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is completely in charge. And in that vein, he notes that there is a reading, he quotes Rabbi Shul of Bells, that it says the pasuk is missing something here, because it says v'yasimeni li'av l'faro u'li'adon l'chol beiso. Each one has a lamed. U'moishol b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. There's no lamed there. Why not l'moishol like all the other ones? So he suggests that the pasuk is really saying that I'm given these two jobs, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu is the moishol b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. He's the one who's in charge of everything, and that's how that all happened. It had nothing to do with me at all. And he then goes on, if you look at the psukim later on, Goldwicht in his essay about this, he notes that at first the brothers, they kind of paraphrase when they go back to Egypt. They say that they go back to Eretz Yisrael, to Canaan, and they tell Yaakov that Yosef is a shalit, he's a ruler, and Yaakov doesn't believe them, and then they repeat everything he said. That's basically the Hemshech psukim. So the Rashiva said that when they were paraphrasing, and they basically made it sound like, oh, Yosef told us he's ruling Mitzrayim. So Yaakov said, that's not Yosef. He doesn't talk that way. It can't be. He wouldn't say that he's the ruler. He would say that God's the ruler, and he wouldn't present himself that way. So then, when he made them repeat it word for word, and they said exactly what he said, Yaakov said, okay, now I believe you. That's my Yosef. That could be the case. So there's a lot to discuss about what exactly this pasuk means. And as we said, the Chasam Sofer understood it to mean that this is a reference to his protection from the society of Mitzrayim. And that's a constant theme that you see here. So for example, the psukim go on to say, Maharu v'alu al aviv, yamarta melav, ko amar bincha Yosef, samani elokim l'adon l'chol Mitzrayim, rido elai al tamod. So as Naim Torah has a comment over here, that this has got to be something that was kind of hard for the brothers to say. The brothers were really jealous of him, and he's giving the message, by the way, tell Abba that I'm king. It's not going to be an easy message for him to carry, but it was necessary because he had to explain, if he's still alive, why he didn't go back and see him. So he has to give him the whole context that I was put in charge of this whole country here, and I can't just leave. So that's a part of the message, but included is also a recognition of the fear that Yaakov's going to have to go into this place, this den of iniquity of Mitzrayim. So he includes within that, V'yashavta v'arz gosha, v'yisti karov elai atah v'nachu v'lo v'necha, v'sonicha v'karcha v'chol ha-shalach, that as the Ramban points out, that Yosef knew that Yaakov would not want to live in the capital. He's not going to want to live in the center of the big city. He's not going to trust the culture there. And therefore, Yosef is telling him, you'll live in Goshen, you'll have a protected home environment, which is evocative a little bit if you want to keep the Hanukkah theme of what the Rosh Hashanah mentioned yesterday at the Mesiva, that the notion of nowadays we light the menorah inside, that once upon a time we lit the menorah outside because the whole message was we needed to protect our home from external influences. Now we need to protect our home from influences that are actually in the house, so we light inside. But whatever it is, this whole notion of the menorah serving as a protection, so that's how the Ramban understands that that's what this reference to Goshen is meant to evoke. Then the pasuk goes on to say, he's the Alfiju, Kalti Oscha, and then the next pasuk, Yibay, says, V'hinei Enechem Ra'os, V'hinei Achi V'nyamin, Ki Pi HaMedaber Eleichem, I'm the one talking to you. So we mentioned before, with Michael's question earlier, the whole issue of the Bris Milah, but also the notion here is that he's speaking in Hebrew. The question is, just like the Bris Milah might not be such great proof, is speaking in Hebrew such a great proof? As the Ramban quotes other Rishonim, Rashi, the Radak, the Ibn Ezra, who say that was the point, that he was speaking in Hebrew. But he points out that this is not really such a great proof of who he is, because the language of Canaan was presumably not that different from the language that was spoken by the cultures around the area at that point. And a king would be likely to know all the languages relevant to the populations with which he interacts. So the idea that he spoke Hebrew is not going to be that impressive. It's not going to really be proof that he's Yosef. So rather, he understands that this was something he was saying in order to calm them down, in order to get them receptive to the idea of what he's trying to convey overall, but not as an absolute proof. While the Meshech Chachma has a couple of other interpretations if you take a look as to what exactly he was trying to accomplish, and others suggest along the lines of what we were saying a few minutes ago, that this is all part of Yosef's trying to convey the message that would go back to his father. I still speak Hebrew, I still speak the same way, I'm still the same tzaddik, I still have protected myself against the pervasive influences, and all of that is something not to worry about. All of that is something that you should have confidence in. So then the pasuk tells us that he gives them this message. V'gartem l'avi, it's called k'vaydi v'mitzrayim, v'zkosher yisem, mihartem v'ratem esavihena, bring him down. V'yipol al tzavari v'nyamen achiv, v'yevk. V'nyamen v'cha al tzavarov. So he fell on the tzavari b'nyamen, and he cried, and b'nyamen cried on his shoulders. So you're probably familiar with the Gemara Maseches Megillah, that Rashi quotes, that why were they crying? They were crying because Yosef saw the Ruach HaKodesh, the two Batei Mikdash and the Chelek of Binyamin that would be destroyed. And Binyamin saw Shiloh that would be destroyed. And they cried over that. So all the Mefarshim ask, why do you have this Rasha? The Pasuk could really easily be understood at the Pshat level. A very emotional moment. So they're crying. So you need to explain. Oh, it was Ruach HaKodesh. They saw future tragedies for the Jewish people. It's a little hard to understand. The Gemara gives you a little bit of a clue because the Gemara says, Tzavarei, plural, how many necks did he have? So it must be a reference to the two Batei Mikdash. We find the word Tzavar in Shir HaShirim, the word Tzavar is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash, which some understand. The Gra understood that it represents a chibur between the Elyonim and the Tachtonim, that just like the Beis HaMikdash is what brings the upper levels into the lower world, so too the neck is what connects the brain to the rest of the body. So it's proper imagery for the Beis HaMikdash. Now the Maharsha says a little differently, it's pride, it's what holds you up. It's what holds your head up. So too, that's what the Beis HaMikdash did for us. So you find it's called that Tzavar. So, but still the question is, why is the Pasuk not read literally? So the Gemara has this question about how many Tzavarim did Binyamin have. But the Torah Tzvimba points out that Rashi doesn't quote that part. Rashi doesn't seem to have that Girsa in the Gemara. And it seems like it's not so unusual to have a plural language for Tzavar in Tanakh. So maybe that's not really the basis of the question. And the Torah Tumima suggests that the Chazal had just told us beforehand that when Yosef says all the brothers are like Binyamin, meaning that just like Binyamin, he's not angry yet because Binyamin wasn't a part of the Mechira, so too he's not angry at anybody, at any event. So if that's the case, so then why is all of a sudden crying on Binyamin? There's something a little bit jarring there. So he suggests that's what inspired the Drasha. Rav Schwab, in his Sefer, he has a medrash that he quotes from Rav Matl Pogromsky, who was the famous Talmud Chacham who died young, and many of the Mechabrim refer to him. I think a biography was just published about him. But he had referred to a medrash that said that when the Beis HaMikdash was built, when the Mishkan was built, when God decided that he's going to bring his presence into this world, that's what brought Simcha into the world. And then when there was a Churban, that's what brought all this tragedy into the world. And now when people cry in happiness, it's because there's such a mixture of sadness and happiness in the world because of that situation. So the notion that people are crying, they could be crying with joy at the situation, even that is connected to the essential confusion that comes about from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Medrash is referring to is that the Pasuk in Yeshaya that's often quoted, Levi, is a Mach Hashem Dima Me'ol Kol Panim, that God will eventually wipe away all the tears. So the Medrash says, even the tears of happiness. So why are the tears of happiness too? His point being that that's a reflection of the taruvus of Tsar and Simcha that we have in this world. So the Tsar still pushes through even in moments of Simcha. I think that psychologically it's explained, people cry at moments of happiness when it's an emotional release, when there's a certain amount of tension in the background and then it's relieved, so then that brings about crying. And again, it's a function of the fact that the Olam Hazeh, as the Vilna Gaon has commented, is a mixture of Tzar and Simcha, and the Simcha that we feel in this world is often because of a relative comparison to the Tzar. And ultimately we seek a time when we'll be able to be happy without having to look relatively to the tzaras. You know, if they had been living happily together all these years, they wouldn't be crying yet. They're only crying, and if you say it's tears of joy that come about the fact that they were separated from all this time. So the notion that we have simcha in this world because of how our tzar and our simcha interacts, we seek a moment in the future when that will no longer be true. And that's how some understand the idea that the Gemara says in Brachos that asur l'malei schok piv v'olam hazad, that we shouldn't fill our mouths with laughter in this world, but the next world, yes, that there's a type of simcha that we just don't reach in this world because of its limitations, and that Yimei HaMashiach, or whatever it is a time when we can really experience pure simcha, not simply in a comparative sense to our tzar. And all of that is, all, even the concept of tears of joy, is a reflection of the Churban situation, which is perhaps what Chazal are conveying here. And Rav Soloveitchik said in a similar time, in a similar sense, that all of the galus that we have is because of the sinas chinam, is because of the fighting amongst the brothers. So at that time, when brothers are reuniting after being separated, it's a time that connects into the tzar of the Churban, whether in a literal sense or not. But it's a time that is roi for the Ruach HaKodesh of the future suffering that's going to connect to that type of a relationship. And the Litzkarev noted as well, Yoznaim Motoru noted as well, that basically this is not really a time for tears of joy in the normal sense, because they've already revealed themselves to each other, they've already reunited. So now they're making the plans. Okay, now go home, and here's a travel plan, here's what you have to do, and bring Yaakov down here. So what that really represents is the beginning of the galus. That begins. This is the process now that will start the exile for the Jewish people. So that was a time of Ruach HaKodesh, of what the future held, and that it evoked this type of crying that Rashi is commenting on. He also notes in the next pasuk that if you look at the times Yosef cries, he cries a lot in Chumash, and a lot of psukim you could collect. And the brothers, they don't cry so much. Yosef does all the crying. So he says that for that reason he's zoche l'gedula. That's how he attained his great stature in life. And presumably what he means, again, it's a reflection of everything that we've been saying in recent contexts, is that this is a reflection of his spiritual sensitivity. This is a reflection of the fact that he is aware of things and he's emotionally connected. And that type of emotional connection is part and reflective of the greatness that allows him to ascend to positions of great influence. But it's also interesting in a halachic sense. So this pasuk is also cited, basically the language of the pasuk, Vayenashek v'cholecha v'yev galehem v'achrechein dibru echa v'ito. So he kissed all his brothers and he cried on them. And so two cryings, where you see two cryings and two adjacent psukim. He's crying a lot. So the idea of kissing all his brothers is invoked by Rashi in a tshuva, that there is a whole discussion about the chiyuv of mechila, about the idea, I spoke about this year, Sarasmei Tshuva, the Beis Medrash, a little bit about this question. It's a highly complex question that the Rishonim talk about without a clear answer, about what really is the end of the story of Yosef and his brothers. Did Yosef really forgive his brothers? It's not 100% clear. To give to some fascinating reading from Rashi Yeshiva here, so by Michael Rosenzweig, Shlita has an essay about this in the first volume of Mitoch Oho, I think in Parshas Miketz, where he talks about the complex reconciliation of Yosef and his brothers. It's not a simple story. And Rav Aaron Kahn, Shlita, has a sefer called something, has a nice title, and in the Sefer he has a kuntris on Mechila, a 200 page kuntris on Mechila, and about 50 pages of that kuntris he's going through the whole story of Yosef and his brothers, trying to figure out really whether it was Mechila or not. It's not a simple question. So Rashi writes in the Tshuva that normally you'd assume that Mechila involves saying to somebody you're Mechila, verbalizing it. But he writes, based on this pasuk, he says, if a person kisses and makes up, if they kiss and hug, so presumably that's mechila. Presumably you don't require to say anything, and that's relevant here. I brought in the two svarim, which I didn't have a chance to look at, but if you want to look, they talk about this issue. These are two brothers, appropriately, two brothers-in-law who wrote these two different svarim, the Aruga Sabosim on Chumash and the Chavasala Sasharan on Chumash. So both of them have all essays about this question, about this Rashi, about this Pasuk, and the implications for Hilchos Mechila, that you assume that that's considered to be an act of Mechila. So the question goes a little bit to the issue of what is Mechila, which again I spoke about the Beis Medrash during Aseres Mechuvah, that is Mechila essentially a release of claims? Or does it mean something which may be more and less than that, just different than that? It essentially means reconciliation, that it's not just that you agree not to prosecute, but you also patch up the differences between the people. So the notion that hugging and kissing is for sure Mechila focuses on the aspect of reconciliation rather than on release of claims, and therefore that could perhaps focus on that element, perhaps illustrate that element. We spoke about then that one of the issues that many Sfarim point out, the notion of asking Mechila before Yom Kippur specifically, is probably reflective of a number of different goals. On the one hand, you don't want to get prosecuted in Shemayim for what you may have done to somebody else. But in addition to that, the notion that our whole tefillah as Klal Yisrael will be more productive on Yom Kippur if we are b'shalom, if we're ba'achdus with each other. And therefore, we have to do what we can to erase all machlokus, to erase all tensions that we have with others. And that's what Mechila is meant to accomplish. And again, so the discussion of the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Bachaya has a number of comments about this, a lot of discussion of the Rishonim about what's going on here is highly relevant. Hi.
In terms of, also we spoke about Aseres Mechuvah, is that one of the goals of the Mechila was a little bit of an embarrassment.
Right, that's in between. Right? So we talked about basically about three goals. That one goal is to get the claims released. The person shouldn't have a tie on you, shouldn't be prosecuting you. The second goal was that maybe the bizoyon that one undergoes through submitting oneself to another for forgiveness is a part of the tshuva process, is itself redemptive. And the third approach was this idea that it's about reconciliation and the notion that Rashi has in the tshuva, that this pasuk is for sure inclusive of that type of mechila, is itself an indication of that. There was a lot of discussion. There's a sefer called Orecha Kamocha. It has a whole list of chakiras about how do you view Mechila. Rav Kahn also has in that essay, a 200-page essay, has a lot about this as well. Whether you view Mechila as a mamonos kind of concept or whether you view it as an emotional kind of concept. Do you see a person releases claims or do you see it as an issue of genuine reconciliation, which has different considerations. Suppose Rabbi Shaul Salanter gave somebody advice. He says, if you want to be a person who's not a captain, a person who rises above his grievances and his nekama natira, so if somebody does something wrong to you, you should immediately be machal. Because then it's too late. You can't take it back. Like, let's say somebody borrows money from you, and you say you're machal, he doesn't have to pay you back. So you can't come back a month later and say, actually, I do need it. If you're mochel, then the loan is gone. There's no longer any debt. You can't undo mechila. So he assumes that it's the same kind of structure, that if that's what's at play, so too in this interpersonal avera mechila, if you're mochel, you can't go back. You can't decide later on your makbid. So that assumes you're following a monetary kind of model. But if you say it's about reconciliation, so if you're mochel too early, then maybe you taka aren't really addressing all the concerns. And maybe that's not really helpful. They also say a story about the stipler, which also kind of sees it in a monetary context. They tell the story that the stipler showed up in Bnei Brak in somebody's bar mitzvah. So he didn't know what he was doing at the bar mitzvah, so he said that 6 years earlier, when this kid was 7 years old, he was davening next to the stipler, and the stipler said something to him that was offensive. It was in violation of Anas Dvarim. So he wanted to ask Mechila, because you're not allowed to be Ma'ana a Katan either. You can't be Ma'ana anybody. So he wanted to ask Mechila, but a Katan is Lav Mei Mechila. A Katan doesn't have the ability to be Mechil, so he had to wait till the kid's Bar Mitzvah, and the moment that happened, he showed up and he asked for Mechila. So that assumes, again, that it's a monetary model. A Katan can't be Mechil on a debt, So therefore, he can't be mochel interpersonally either. One could argue that it's a different type of mechila, that cotton can definitely reconcile. So you have to figure out what exactly is the nature of mechila as a chiyuv, and that's a little bit what's happening here as well. So just mention one other idea. This goes to Shmuley's question before. So the psukim will continue, and it says, "V'hakol nishma beis paro lemor." Bao achay Yosef, yitav beir far v'nei avoda, v'yomer paro Yosef, v'mor lachecha, zolso su, tanu es b'irchem, v'luchu bo'u arts t'kanat, v'kchu es avichem, v'yaspatechem, v'vo'u elai, v'yatna lachem es, tuv ha'aretz Mitzrayim, v'yichlu es chelev ha'aretz. And he says, come, bring your whole family, bring your father, bring your brothers, and we'll treat them phenomenally. So there's Naim Latorah comments here that you see that Paro is not only he's very hospitable, but he's also lacking any kind of xenophobia. He's not afraid of strangers. He says he's not anti-Semitic. He says, I don't want to say, put a quarter on the Jewish people. He says, bring your whole family, bring all the Jews. And we had such bracha from the one Jew who we have, so imagine if we bring his whole family, it'll probably also be a tremendous source of bracha. So again, this is part of the positive portrayal of Paro that we find in Sefer Bereishis, which is in stark contrast to the portrayal that we find in Sefer Shmos. And as we mentioned before, that if they are indeed the same person, then it's all the more tragic tale. But that's just one more reflection of the qualities that we associate with Paro. Okay, so maybe trying to decide whether we should start this topic. Maybe we'll start this topic, and if we need, we'll continue it on Sunday. Otherwise, we'll go to the next sugya, which is about Afen Hoyibos on Ace. But the question of electric menorahs, which, similar to other things we've talked about in the past, is clearly a modern shaila. It's not a sugya in the Gemara. But the way it's been discussed, it connects to sugyas that we've seen recently. So it seems an appropriate time to discuss it. So just to say a few words about it, it's a big machlokas about whether or not electric menorahs are acceptable. So we could skip to the end of the discussion and basically say that it's not really clear one way or another. It's essentially a suffix that there is basis to say it should work. The same way we find when it comes to Friday night and Yontif, that there is a strong basis to say that electric lights are sufficient for the purposes of Neir Shabbos. So if that's the case, and it ties in a little bit to the question of the Isser, of Malacha and Shabbos as well, that if we assume that turning on a light is an act of Havara, that an incandescent light bulb with a filament inside is a type of Havara, so then maybe one could say it's for all purposes a type of Havara, and for mitzvahs as well, so it should be valid for Neir Shabbos, and it should be valid for Neir Chanukah also. So on the surface, that seems to be a reasonable assumption, but there were various considerations that Poskim had against this usage. So the considerations are all chidushim. Well, none of them are obvious. We don't have any direct mucker that says that you can't do this. So one could say that if we do come to the conclusion that it's fire and that it's a malach of havara to turn on the light and that it's acceptable as Neir Shabbos, so you do come from a position of strength to say that it should count for Neir Chanukah as well, because the objections are, for the most part, chidushim. But because there are some significant objections, so then the attitude that we would generally take is that if it's possible to use regular non-electric candles, so then that would be best. But in circumstances where it's not possible, such as we mentioned airplanes might be a possibility, or hospital rooms are definitely such a situation, so then it's clearly a lot better than nothing, because there is a big basis to accept it. And that's something to factor in. Hi.
What's the time to say that electricity is havara, or is it?
Not electricity as a whole, but specifically light bulbs that have a filament inside of them that light up, that basically get hot, right? And light, an incandescent light bulb is hot, so that filament is made to glow.
Even if there's no flame?
Yeah, that's what it seems like. That sounds like from the Rambam. The Rambam says that if you heat up metal, You know, that would be, so essentially that's what's happening inside the incandescent light bulb, so then that would be the case. Now, there's still room to say, the post can consider also, that maybe you don't even need that, that maybe you could have, they also talk about gas lights, like fluorescent lights, which maybe you don't even have that much, but maybe that should still count for Neres Chanukah, because who knows what we need for Neres Chanukah. Maybe it's just about having light. So, again, there is, especially when you're dealing with light bulbs, so there is a strong basis to say that it should work, but we need a, you know, we kind of need backup for it, and we have these objections, so we wouldn't tell someone to do this l'chatchila, but in the absence of other options, it has what to be said for it. And so just what are some of the objections? So the objections, again, are all chidushim. It was discussed among those who discussed this prominently. It was discussed by the Tshuvas Beis Yitzchak, not to be confused by our journal, but Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkis and his Tshuvas in a few places. And then more recently by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is known for Kol Torah Kula, but he's also known specifically for his expertise and his writings on the topics of electricity. He has a whole sefer about it, the Marei Eish, and the relevant passages are reprinted in the Tshuvas Mincha Shlomo. And the Rav Shlomo Zalman's involvement in the field of electricity is well known, both l'kula and l'chumra. He doesn't actually consider it an actual malacha for the most part in terms of electricity itself. And he's also very convinced that one cannot be yotze brachos and shofar and the like through microphones. So he has certain strong views about electricity, which are not necessarily always what's accepted. It's a little bit of a discussion, but he's very prominent on the Kol Torah Kula scene, but on the electricity scene specifically. So he has writings about this. So among the issues to talk about is, first of all, is there a requirement of Shmanim Upsilos? That we start off our whole sugya talking about Kol HaShmanim V'Apsilos that are kosher for Shabbos, kosher for menorah. So is that an actual requirement? Do you need Shmanim Upsilos? So that was what some of these poskim thought, maybe not. Or is it in Menamuvchar? The Gemara says that Shemen Zayis is a Shemen is a mitzvah Menamuvchar. So how does that affect the equation? The Maharal, who wrote a sefer on Chanukah near mitzvah, the Maharal was actually of the view that you have to use oil and that wax candles are not acceptable for Chanukah candles. We don't accept that view, really. Our practice is to allow candles. And the Rambam writes, he says, in our Medinos, we use candles, their light is as good as Shemen Zayis, the candles that we have nowadays, in his days already. So if we allow candles, so then we're moving away from the Shemen model. But if we take the Maharal's view, then we really might be limited specifically to Shemen, and then electricity would be a more complicated option. So Rav Shlomo Zalman also discusses that two different questions. Can you have the absence of Shemen, can you have the absence of Psilos? So either one of those you have to figure out independently. And among the issue is, the sugya that we've basically been talking about this week, the question of to what extent do we have to parallel the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash? So is there an assumption that the menorah in our house will model itself after the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash? Or do we assume, no, it's got differences, and this difference could include something like the usage of electricity. So I saw one contemporary mechaber, Rabbi Yitzchak Perlman, wrote an article in the Journal of Akshay Torah, where he notes as an overall theme here that we do find, clearly we find differences between the menorah, the Beis HaMikdash, and our house. We spoke about many of them this week. So he suggests that Chazal clearly deviated a little bit from the Beis HaMikdash, and in general, that was because of Persumei Nisa, that we need to have Persumei Nisa, and we need to have reasonable access to light in order to do that. So it was kind of a compromise, a balance of having some connection to the Beis HaMikdash while allowing for deviations that will enhance Persumei Nisa. So we have to figure out what exactly Persumei Nisa requires and when that allows us to deviate from the model of Menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. So that's a part of the question. And separate from the question of whether specifically we're interested in the Beis HaMikdash, but also because of the Nais, if the Nais involved that Menorah, so to what extent do we have to match that? So there are those who maintain, and Shlomo Zalman discusses this as well, that you need something that is consumable. It's just like oil is consumable, it's eventually going to disappear. So okay, so a wax candle will also disappear, but electricity is not going to go down, so to speak, is not going to disappear, so maybe that's not a proper model. And others don't think there is any such concept. There's a lot of back and forth about this. There is a sefer called Kochve Yitzchak, it was written by a Rav from Baltimore, Rav Yitzchak Sternhill. So in the first chelek of his sefer, in Siman Hey and Siman Vav, he has a very lengthy discussion about this, and he seems to incline towards allowing electric menorahs, so he goes at great length to refute all of the objections that the Svarim have, and to consider every other angle of why you don't have to say this way, you don't have to say that way. He doesn't necessarily think you have to accept all these points. Hi.
In terms of the point that, let's say, electricity isn't used up quite like oil or waxes, mm-hmm. So one be able to make a chiluk there between a battery powered and...
Yes, I was about to get to that. That has another big difference, but a big difference the cooler in favor of batteries, which we'll talk about in a second. It's even more relevant to our sugya. So we'll just try to mention this in a few minutes, and then we'll dive in. But among the other objections, so some also raise the question of Persumei Nisa in terms of Hecker, that the idea is if we have electric lights all around, so then electric lights for menorah is not going to really accomplish anything. So Rav Yashiv has a tshuvas printed in the Kovetz Tshuvas, where he says that the Beis Yitzchak, Yitzchak Shmelkis, objected because of Persumei Nisa ultimately. He factors in a bunch of different things, but he thinks he objected because of that. So he says, so that's a problem, you have to worry about that. But if one could do it in a way that there is Persumei Nisa, so then it would be okay, he says. So presumably, for example, if one has a specially designed electric menorah, that's a menorah, but it's electric, so then presumably that would address the Persumei Nisa considerations, because that's not what people use for light in their household. And it is distinct. By contrast, Rav Henkin, in his tshuvas, Rav Gosvelio Henkin, a very short tshuva that was printed in the Yeshurun Journal, it just came out with a edition of the Yeshurun Journal, which reprints a lot of material on Chanukah and Purim. So there's a short tshuva from Rav Henkin, where Rav Henkin wrote that the Beis Yitzchak asked, so we shouldn't do it, we shouldn't have it, and he goes beyond what everyone else says, he says, so therefore we shouldn't even have them, because that may give people the impression that it's valid. So that's a less common attitude, because most assume that even if we worry about the objections that the other posts can have, but it's a better option if you have no other options, and it's not harmful element. So it's really Henkin's unique in that, in saying that he thinks it's problematic as far as that's concerned. So there are various attitudes, and this article by Perlman that we mentioned a moment ago, so he has some hashkafic points there also. He says that the menorah is supposed to be me'al ha'teva, and it's got to be a flame that goes above something, and this is an exact model, and why Shemazayas is good. So he has certain hashkafic reasons why he's not really so thrilled about this, but we'll just mention one other objection which comes out of our sugi that we just finished. So in terms of halakha osa mitzvah, so we mentioned that the Rush says that because we paskin halakha osa mitzvah, that means the halakha has to be done with oil the oil there. You can't add oil later. So based on that, so many poskim thought that maybe it was a question that if you have a plugged in menorah, so the only reason it continues to function is because the electric company, the people are continuously supplying you with power. And if they were to stop supplying you with power, so then you wouldn't have it. So it's basically like not having a shear. You don't have a shear when you light it. You're relying on power to be supplied later, and that's comparable to adding in oil after the initial hadlaka. So if that's the objection, so that goes to Jonathan's point, so then if you have a battery-operated menorah, so then that probably gets rid of that problem. And you are possessing all of the power right now as you turn on the light. But beyond that, there is reasons to question whether or not this is really the case. And the Kochvi Yitzchak and others, they take issue with this. And they point out that you don't really have a shear. When you talk about a shear, the shear means that it's got to last a half hour, but that doesn't tell you how much oil you have to have. So let's say you were to find out that a drop of oil could last a half hour, then it'll become a drop. It's going to be a different amount. It's not like Chazal said, a certain specific amount of oil. So it's hard to relate to it in that type of a way. And presumably also, the way we understood it, is that we talk about a shear, it means that you have to have, that even though we say, kovsa lo zakuk lo, you're not liable if it goes out, but you have to have the potential for it to last. So if you lit with an incomplete shear, the problem is it doesn't have potential to last. But that's not an issue with the electric menorah, that even though the electric company may decide to go out of business in the middle of your candle lighting, or maybe a blackout, but when you turn on the electric menorah, it has the potential to last. And it has the expectation of a last, probably more likely to last than the fire menorah. So what do you mean when you say it has to have the shear? If we understand it simply as meaning that you have to have the potential to last, so then this menorah does that. So it's a good question whether you really have to have such an objection. You have to figure out exactly what it means to say you have to have the shear. Rav Shlomo Fisher has an essay. Rav Shlomo Fisher is a phenomenal Talmud Chacham who's alive today. He wrote the Sefer Beis Yishai. So the Beis Yishai, he discusses that, so we mentioned that the Rush's, the idea of having Hashir has been extended by many poskim to say that if you light in a place where it's too windy, then it's no good, because that's also doomed, it's not going to last. And then we discussed, we talked about Kavsa Zakuk La and intent, so we discussed the whole question of what if you light in a little glass house, but it's open to the wind right now, but you're going to close the door so the little glass will protect it. And we mentioned how Shlomo Zalman thought that was that we factor in intent, and that Chaim Kanievsky mentioned that as what helps here, because we intend to fix it in a second. But there were poskim, Maril Diskin and others, who said it's a problem, because when you light, hadlaka osa mitzvah, when you light, it's exposed, and the fact that you're going to fix it a second later shouldn't help. Parenthetically, it's interesting, by the way, in the sugi of Malikim Miner Lener, if you look in the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch, so it says there that if you're Mekel Amalikim Miner Lener, so that may upset our whole Hablaka Osa Mitzvah, right? Because let's say you have one candle here, and you don't want to use an intermediary, so you want to light from the candle directly, so you're going to have to take a new candle, bring it to the first candle, and then place it into its slot. So what about Hablaka Osa Mitzvah? You do the Hablaka where it's not in the right place. So he writes there, the Shulchan Aruch, that maybe for a few seconds we're not worried. That Hablaka Osa Mitzvah, you can be a few seconds off. You can move it right after lighting it into the right place. So if that's the case, then you don't have really an issue here either. So Shlomo Fisher writes that he thinks the objection that the Maharal Diskin had and others had to saying that even if you're going to close the glass house, it's a problem because when you lit it, it's exposed. He said he doesn't believe that could be true. He says this is the Derech HaMadlikin, this is the way you do it. And if this was really a halacha, poskim throughout history would have objected to it, and it can't be. He says, got to be, that's fine, that you light it and you immediately fix it, that's okay. And yet, we have this halacha that you have to have all the shemen in there to begin with. So, apparently, what that halacha means, he writes, so some understand that because you assume the shemen is all one entity, that the halacha requires it to be done on all of the shemen together. So, that's a little bit beyond the idea of potential. Whether or not that it has any implications for battery power, again, I'm not sure. It seems to be that one can make a case that it shouldn't have implications. And again, if you look at the Sefer Koch V'Yitzchak, so he goes at great length about this issue of the shear. He doesn't think it's a problem for many reasons, but he points out also that the whole concept of a shear, as we mentioned, we're not 100% sure of the halacha that's required, and he pointed out many Rishonim who thought it wasn't required. You may remember we saw was called in the name of Rebbeinu Tam, the Upaskin Lakula, and both suffix and both Sfeikus in the Gemara. So you don't really need a shear. So he has a whole many pages. It goes on for why he doesn't think we necessarily have to be have this objection taken too seriously. So again, essentially, as a matter of halacha, so you see that there is a strong basis to say that it might work, and there are a lot of objections in poskim. Many poskim did think that because there's all these Sfeikus, we shouldn't rely on it by itself. So that's clearly a important thing to factor in. But if somebody doesn't have other options, if somebody's on an airplane, if somebody's in a hotel room, or a hospital room, let's say, even more pointedly, so then it's definitely something to factor in, because there are many reasonable positions to be taken that it is at least on some level a fulfillment of the obligation of Ne'er Chanukah. So then the bracha, I guess, becomes a little bit of a suffix. It depends on your attitude about the bracha. And there does seem to be what to rely on, but in general, because of the attitude of all these poskim who are a little bit hesitant, probably say Safek Brachos L'Hakel. We mentioned that Rabbi Yaakov Emden doesn't want to say that in general, but we haven't accepted his position. So probably you would leave out the bracha. But it's a little bit of a close call. Okay, so then we'll stop on that point. We'll daven mincha now. It's our last Al Nisan. So